reuse names and recycle names. Right now, no. So if Dark Knight is taken and then Dark Knight kills himself, Dark Knight is dead. Okay? No one else can assume the identity. In later revisions of the software, we're looking at things like XML meta tags and incorporating some of the web of trust stuff that PGP has done in a very easy way. So what you can automatically do is, if we did decide to open up the name Dark Knight, you could look and say, how old is this Dark Knight? This Dark Knight has been Dark Knight for 6 months. It's absolutely unique, but there was a previous Dark Knight that died a year ago. And you could look at which reputation signatures this Dark Knight has accumulated. So somewhat like if you look up a person's PGP key, you can see webs of trust. So this person may say, this Dark Knight is friends with Dark Avenger and Spider-Man and, you know, Louis Free at freedom.net. And these are all pseudonyms, and they've all signed his identity. And so you can recognize this identity is different from the Dark Knight I was talking to before, which is reinforcing this idea of persistence and reputation.
And of course, all this needs to be done in a way that the user has to know nothing about crypto. So somewhat this, it relates to work I've done previously in visual fingerprinting and being able to draw pictures representing public keys and hashes in a way that users that know nothing can recognize keys and tell when a public key has changed. Basically, a NIM is a public key, right? That's one of the, at the bottom crypto layer, that's what's going on. The name associated with the NIM is basically a label for user's convenience. If we can give it other labels that the user can use to check, oh, this is actually a different John Smith. Or maybe, if you think about it, the problem's not different from having a John - Smith and a John _ Smith and a John dot Smith, right? Though you can have all three of those pseudonyms and they'd be different people. So we anyways need some way to help the user differentiate between different similar looking NIMs. In the back. Okay, that of course is the fundamental question, right? So, as the latter half, no. If you come to us with a subpoena, the name of the company is Zero Knowledge for a reason. We have no non-public information. Any information that Zero Knowledge has is basically in the NIM server that can be downloaded by anyone. So there's basically 0 point coming to our offices with a subpoena. You can just use a web browser to get the same information. As to the question of compromising servers, obviously, if all the servers are compromised, you're toast.
By the same party.
By the same or colluding parties. And if none of them are, you're not. So there's some value in between there where you're statistically toast. One of the hard research problems is, of course, figuring out just what that number is. It's going to be, if you look at other systems like crowds from, what are they now? AT&T Research, I think, is the part that now has crowds. They went and proved some nice theorems that said you have to compromise a constant fraction of the total number of nodes. So it's linear in the number of nodes, which is an okay result.
Well, to follow up, what's going to be, say, a single agency from groups that are almost not forces volunteering to set up enormous number of servers so that
right. So basically the answer is reputation capital. So when you sign up to run a server, it's indicated in the network information database what organization is running it. So, I mean, obviously if 100 of them are, say, NSA, you just don't do that. But the question, of course, is, well, they're not going to say NSA. They're going to say National Society of Audubon or something. And it won't be obvious that they're all run by the same people. But conversely, they're not run by anyone you trust. Right? So one's run by the EFF, run by people you know, Toad.com or Dis.org, whatever. If you trust those people, you can explicitly say, I want to use that node. And as long, to first approximation, as long as any one of the nodes in your chain is trusted, you're okay. It's not 100% true because of active and statistical attacks, but to first approximation. And note that you don't have to actually trust them, you just have to trust them not to collude. Right? So if I want to run, if I want to run a route through both the U.S. government running a node and the Iraqi government running a node, I mean, that would be, I would be more than happy with that. Yeah.
Okay. If you know nothing about your clients, have you built them?
Oh, that's an extremely good question. Okay. So, how do we bill the clients? This is something we haven't mentioned yet. This is a service-based model, so you pay for NIMS, basically. You don't pay for the software, right? The software is free. You can just download it off the website. You pay for NIMS. And what that means, really, is you pay Zero Knowledge to put their stamp of authenticity in the public key infrastructure on your key. Okay, so... Well, that would be awesome, right? And that's something we can think about later. But what happens is this. When you get a copy of the software and you want to buy NIMS, you somehow get us money. We prefer you use, for this reason, some anonymous way, but credit cards is okay, it turns out. Because what we do, we don't give you NIMS. We give you a serial number, just like the ones we're going to hand out. Can I show some, like a sample thing?
Yeah.
So, this is a sample little serial number thing. We'll be handing out a whole slew of these shortly. Look how packed the room is at 10:45 in the morning. So, on this thing, there's this longish serial number on the back. And what happens is the... credit card number basically is associated with the serial number, and that serial number basically authorizes you to create, say, 5 NIMS. Okay? And I'll get to that thing in a minute. So you can imagine there's this stack of these things in a store, even, and you walk into a store, you pay $10, and you get one of these things. That would be great. Question is now, okay, so now the credit card number is associated with this. How do you go on down the line? So, as they say, all problems in computer science can be solved with an extra level of indirection. So what we do is, now you have the serial number. So serial numbers aren't exchanged for NIMS. They're exchanged for tokens. Okay? So when you cash in this serial number, you'll get downloaded to the Freedom client, say, 5 tokens, where each token is good to create or extend the life of one NIM. Now, in the ideal situation, these tokens use digital cash technology that allows you to do things like create tokens that are unlinkable and untraceable, basically anonymous electronic cash things. There are a few problems with patents we're working out right now, but... the fallback is basically auditing of our system to ensure people that we are not linking serial numbers and token numbers. Okay, there's no reason for us to do it. For various commerce rules reasons that have to do with accepting credit cards, you have to record what thing it was you sold by a credit card, so in particular the serial number. But we don't have to, and in fact we explicitly do not, link the serial number to any kind of identifier of the tokens. And we hope to soon move to a way where it's just totally impossible for us to do that, and verifiably so. And then, of course, the tokens are easily redeemable for NIMs.
There's actually some practical reasons why we want to know you as a customer, but not your NIMs. You install our software, and God forbid you can't get online anymore. Something went wrong. You call up our customer service line. You want patches sent to you. You want a new CD sent to you. You're interacting with a customer service agent. You know, we can have on the call center, please never disclose your NIM to one of our agents. We will never ask you. But that is dependent on the fact that we can know you. So Austin Hill is a user of Freedom. That's fine. Everyone can know that. I can call up customer service. I can interact. But there is an absolute separation between my NIMs. So if I'm trying to get support for my NIMs, I just do it through the website. If I'm trying to get support as a user, I can call up and be Austin Hill.
Yeah. Oh. Okay, we'll take this one first, and we'll go in.
Sorry for retreading the Dallas host tax, but you were talking about the load balancing, and I'm reminded of a certain AT&T crash a few years back. That seems very vulnerable to that. Is there any defense against that, or is that
just... So the AT&T crash obviously had a very particular, it had its own special problems, right? In general, though, the problem, as we see with the power outage in the Southwest a little while back, you can have cascading failures if the total amount of throughput of the system is greater than the remaining throughput when one of the machines the remaining available bandwidth when one of the machines goes down, right? Then obviously you have no choice but to have some kind of catastrophic failure, because you have no choice. I mean, you just have too much data flowing through the system, right? Well, so that's catastrophic for at least some people, right? Some people are cut off at this point. Right, so you just have to vastly over-provision your bandwidth so one node failing does not cause this catastrophic side effect. And hopefully you don't get some large... I mean, if power goes out in the U.S. come Y2K, well, okay, so our servers will go down, but... we have other problems. What's that? Yeah. Okay. Of what? We have no idea, because betas are still ramping up like crazy. So, yeah. So that's something we're measuring in the beta period. Yeah, in the back. Use your friends? Right. So, the answer is kind of yes and no. At the sort of API level, right? At a protocol level, the client can obviously control explicitly what route he wants to take through the network. I'm pretty sure the client does not, or at least the current version, even in the most advanced setting, does not allow you to manually construct routes. It can say, go through these trusted nodes that I want to use, but not particular stuff. But the main question is, can I... if, say, I've owned, like, three servers out there, and out of 2,000, can I, like, have my friends bog down the other 1,997 servers so that everyone will load balance through us? Of course, as soon as you've done that, your three servers are going to be totally congested and no longer will be the three best servers.
We actually put this in the code.
Oh, it's in the code now. Hey, these people code faster than I can invent things.
The client lists all available routes. So when the client goes to construct a route, depending on its settings, it calculates what are the total number of routes. So if there, and we have certain thresholds, if there aren't a certain X amount of routes possible, then warn the customer, because everyone will be using the same route, and it's essentially a security violation. So we can define X, and we haven't defined what X should be. That's where he comes in.
All right. Question there?
How easy is it to dynamically configure those routes? That's one question. The second question, with respect to the collision issue, is it possible to hack the last server, and now you have access to you.
Okay, I'll answer both those questions. So all routes are dynamically created, right? When if a route fails for some reason, a new one is dynamically generated. I'm not sure exactly.
The user did say I want to configure one now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Can it be automatically set every 5 minutes?
Yes, in fact, it does do that.
Every half an hour.
Every half an hour now, I think it does it, but it's a tweakable knob. The second question was, what happens if you just compromise the last server? So if you just compromise the last server, basically that's one of the more useless servers to compromise, because half the information it knows you already know, right? The information between the last server and, say, the web server is already sent unencrypted, right? Because the web server has no special software running on it. So all you'd get from that is, if you totally could compromise it, all you could get from it is the identity of the second of last server. Then, of course, you'd have to go compromise that and compromise that and back through the chain, all while the connection is up, right? And, of course, since the connections change every half an hour, you have half an hour to backtrack through this connection. And this applies just as much to technical attacks, like trying to own the servers one at a time, as it does to political attacks, trying to serve them with a subpoena. The latter, of course, is mostly foiled if the second from last server is in Turkmenistan. Basically, we give you a very limited amount of time to successfully perform your attack, and if you fail, you basically have to start all over again.
How can the dynamic route creation, recreation, also the routing around, you know, when a server goes down, take place if, in theory, none of the servers, you know anything about anybody except the one server they're talking to and the one server is talking to them?
That's what we mean by that is, in any one given route, the servers only know which is the previous and next hops in the route. As global states, servers are exchanging information a lot, manner of BGP. It's figuring out, trying to get a total picture of the network state. So when one server goes down, that information will propagate quickly, and basically pretty soon the whole network will know, oh, server foo went away, and that information will be reflected back to the client. So when the client notices, oh, my bandwidth stopped, I should recreate a route, it will have also received the information server foo went away, so it shouldn't try to create a route through server foo.
Find that information to recreate a route without the servers having anything to do with recreating a route.
That's right. Servers don't create routes. Clients create routes. The servers just are involved in propagating the information about who's up, who's down, and somewhat about how well they're performing. Yeah, over there.
Two questions. First of all, there are spammers who use throwaway email addresses. And there are those who use electronic countermeasures against those spammers. How will you deal with that? And secondly, how is Freedom better than Anonymous?
Okay, so two really good questions. Do the first one first, spam. I'm surprised no one has said the word spam yet, in fact. We have actually a great answer. So there are two problems with spam. One is keeping people from sending spam, and the second is keeping spam from arriving in your mailbox. Okay? The first one's actually pretty easy. Spammers have to send some huge number of emails in order for it to be worth their while. Right? 18,000 an hour is what I hear mumbling over in the corner here.
Mumble.
So the simplest solution is, since all outgoing email has to be anonymized through our system anyway, we just cap the number of emails you can send.
Well, what I'm picking up, though, is all spammers have a return address. Email.
Sure.
That would be the destination of any responses, and some of us here respond with electronic countermeasures, filling that box up with crap and illicit server subscriptions in response.
Yeah, so but spammers wouldn't be able to use a Freedom NIM in order to send spam.
Ooh.
you're talking about Dropboxes.
Right.
So in the area of spam, if you actually look at all the techniques spammers use, sometimes they use Dropboxes. So they'll use an open mail relay to send 20,000 emails in an hour with a totally different Dropbox on the other end. So now the problem with that is I can use a Dropbox that I don't own because the other system has no authentication. So we can't by default flip off that Dropbox because we have no way of knowing if that's actually owned by the spammer or if it's a denial of service attack to that NIM. So there's a couple thresholds and things we can do. One is the other part of Ian's response, which is we give users the ability to block all spam from ever entering their email address. So we can kill spam to a NIM, 99.9%. So you can use your NIM out in a news group, and that's the reason we've done it, without getting bombarded by spam. Because if you're trying to build a persistent identity and relation and reputation, you don't want to have to abandon that email address a year out because of so much spam. So our spam filtering is very high. So if someone were to do that, you could essentially block out all of the countermeasures that you're talking about. But we also do a header verification and digitally signed headers so that we can verify if an email message actually ever came from our network. And if it did, we can shut down that NIM. We don't know who it is, but we can either shut them down or lower their spam count threshold. So if someone is allowed normally to send 300 messages a day, and we start getting tons of complaints about spam with legitimate digitally signed headers, we can just threshold him down to 20 emails a day so that it's very hard for him to continue using that mailbox for spam.
So in fact, that can happen automatically. If someone tries to send more than 300 emails a day, that number can just automatically go down without having complaints. Complaints, I think, should probably cut off the NIM entirely if it's actual verifiable spam. So Austin's answered the second half of the first question about the spam. So we protect people from receiving spam using means that some really techno-savvy people are using today, using an automated challenge response type system, if the user really wants to turn it on. But so that's a pretty good spam protection mechanism. Problem is, it's really complicated to use. Users have no idea how to use this. Luckily, we're mediating their email, right? So we can add these complicated technical countermeasures to spam, and users just get it for free. So now the second question, anonymizer. So what's the difference between Freedom and the anonymizer? So the anonymizer, if you're not familiar... Whoa, people just keep filing in. So the difference between Freedom and the anonymizer basically is a way to anonymize your web surfing. And in a nutshell, basically it's you connect to the anonymizer and the anonymizer connects to the website. And then the website doesn't learn any information about you. Okay, so there are, for all these privacy-enhancing technologies, as it's so-called, there are a couple of axes you can plot their positions on. One is their utility. What kinds of things do they help you anonymize? So the anonymizer is basically for web surfing. It does a bit of email now, but that's it. Freedom, on the other hand, is at the IP level. So basically any IP-based protocol, it can or potentially can make pseudonymous. And the other axis is how resistant is it to attack? So if you have a single proxy in the middle where everything's going through, if Lance, the guy who runs it, is compromised, then basically all information is lost. So if he is subpoenaed, he can certainly give out information about who is talking to whom. Third difference is that the anonymizer is an anonymous service, whereas Freedom is a pseudonymous service. And the pseudonymity allows you to do things like reputation capital and things like this. Although the anonymizer's new mail subsection does allow the use of persistent pseudonyms. So it's getting to 11 o'clock, and I think people would be like really interested in getting these serial numbers and shirts and cool stuff like that.
One or two last questions.
So everyone's getting up and is going to storm us. So seeing as how there's another talk in here, like very soon, I think the best thing would be to take the tchotchkes out like into the hallway.